Hi, my name is Sam Williams, and welcome to part two of episode number 103 of my sexy music podcast, The Millennial Throwback Machine. So first, I'd like to welcome all you to part two of episode number 103 of my sexy music podcast, The Millennial Throwback Machine. I'm Sam Williams, and for those of you who are just now discovering this podcast, either on the Apple Podcast app, or in Stitcher, or on iHeartRadio, Google Play Music, or on Spotify, and you're wondering, so what the heck is, I'm going to give you a brief description of what the show is all about. Okay, so I'm Sam Williams, and I'm a 24-year-old songwriter slash producer, but I'm also a huge 60s music fan slash expert slash nerd. And each week of this podcast, I take one song by one artist from the 60s and split the show into two parts. First part of the show is talk about my opinion of the song and why I think it's so good or why I think it sucks, and do my own personal analysis on the arrangement of the song, which will include the chords, melody, and lyrics. And the second part of the show, dig deep into the history behind that track. And that part of the show, talk about who wrote the song, who produced it, what studio the song is recorded at, who are the musicians on the track, whether it be the band members, the session musicians themselves, and the songwriter that wrote the song, and the guys that produced it, and the history behind the producers and the writers of the song, and the artists that recorded it originally, and what studio the song was recorded at, where that studio was located at, and the label the song's released on, where that label is located at, and the name of the label as well, the song was released on, and the year and month the song was released, and the peak position the song made up originally on the Billboard Hot 100 chart when it was originally released. All that is in the second part of the show. Now, before we move on to this week's episode of the podcast, I wanted to just take a quick moment to say that I'm sorry that this week's episode is coming to you guys a little bit later than what you're probably expecting me to drop this week's episode, because, you know, to be honest with you guys, it's been very, very difficult for me to manage my time as of the last two or three weeks. You know, I've just, it's not necessarily you, it's just that I've been so distracted with doing a ton of other things other than just this podcast. I mean, I'm still working on the book of, you know, related to this podcast, which I hope to be out, have out by the end of this year or before the end of this year, and I think that's probably what's going to happen. But I've been working on that, and I've been trying to, you know, also work on my website and rebuild that, and that's been taking up a lot of my time. But also, because of the quarantine and the reduced amount of inhuman interactions that I've been having lately, specifically with my friends and basically everyone else except for my family, because of that, I have been resorting to getting into some old habits that I used to have, you know, before the quarantine. Or actually, a long time ago. I mean, you know, when I was younger, I used to watch a lot of classic TV shows from the 60s, and I used to play a bunch of video games. Well, I've recently gotten back into doing a lot of those things. And to be honest with you, those have been a major distraction for me lately, and I've been doing my best to try to not do as much of those things, but the fact that I'm very limited with the amount of friends I can see on a regular basis now because of the situation we're currently in with the coronavirus, have just haven't, you know, that has been doing that's been a great distraction for me to distract myself from what's currently going on in our world right now. And I mean, I've just been doing a lot of that lately, and I know I probably should be doing less of that, and we should be focusing on my podcast and my book and some other things too, but, you know, it's just hard to manage my time between doing all of that, really. And I know I'll figure this one out, but bear with me, guys. I haven't forgotten about you guys at all. I mean, I'm doing my best to put out an episode of the show every week. And I haven't really taken any breaks, really, other than last month, and actually during the month of May, I took a pretty long break, you know, but I'm still doing this podcast, so I'm going to keep putting out episodes every week for as long as I can. And so, I mean, trust me, I haven't forgotten about you guys. I'll still do my best to put out an episode for you guys every week, but I've just been super distracted with other stuff right now. So if an episode, you know, that I put out comes out later than you were expecting, because maybe you were thinking I was going to put out an episode on a specific day, but you were kind of disappointed when you found out I didn't put it out. That's the reason why. That's, you know, it's because I've just been really distracted with doing other stuff lately. But I definitely am still doing this podcast. I haven't forgotten about you guys. I'll do my best to keep putting out content for you guys, for you to listen to every week. Moving on, let's talk about the history behind last week's song and artist. And more importantly, let's talk about the label this song was released on. And that song was the original Baby On For Real. Well, this song was released on Motown Records. And the main reason why I've been kind of avoiding talking about Motown on this podcast, other than that one songwriter from Motown that I interviewed, is because I'm trying to differentiate myself from other podcasts out there that are all about rock and roll history. And I'm trying not to talk about the same artists and songs that, you know, other podcasts about rock and roll history talk about. And, you know, and I know that there are other podcasts out there about rock and roll history, and they talk about Motown extensively. And yeah, and that's why I've been trying to avoid talking about them, because I just don't, I just really want to separate myself from them, you know, and give you off you guys different kind of songs and artists and talk about different things than what they're talking about. Well, I'm going to try to still do that, even though this is a Motown song, and I know a lot of people have already covered Motown very much in with their other shows, but with this episode, I'm going to do my best to inform you guys about them and give you guys some little known facts about the label that you may or may not have been aware of, even though, you know, the history behind Motown is pretty much common knowledge, you know, especially if you're a fan of oldies music. But in this week's episode, I'm going to do my best to try to give you guys some little known facts about Motown that, you know, aren't necessarily as common knowledge as what you would think. It would be common knowledge, but trust me, I mean, there's a lot of things about this record company has a very deep and long history. You know, it stretches back quite a years. And listen, I'm not gonna try to cover the entire history of Motown on this one episode of this podcast, because if I wanted to cover the whole history behind this label, I would have to split this into a 3-part podcast. You know, because, you know, but I'm going to do my best to try to condense it and just try to, you know, basically talk about them, you know, cover the surfacey things and give you some little known facts and try to keep it condensed so that way I can move on to something else next week. But I'm definitely going to, try to give you some interesting facts about them that you may not have known about Motown specifically. Because again, there are a lot of historical things about them. They put out a lot of music, and I'm going to do my best to try to educate you guys about them and give you some little known information about them that you probably don't know specifically about them. Okay, so here's the thing. One thing that a lot of people probably wonder about Motown is that we all know the songs, right? We know the artists. We know the people that came out of Motown that had huge careers. We know Stevie Wonder. We know Michael Jackson. We know all those huge names that all got started on the Motown label. And, you know, we know songs by the Supremes and the Temptations, and we know songs by Marvin Gaye. We know about all those artists, but how do people really know how Motown got started? And I know a lot of people do, but do people really know where the idea of the label really came from? Well, let me put it to you this way. Motown was a label that was started actually in the late 50s. And it was one of those labels that, you know, at the time wasn't very unique. It was just another independent label started by a black person, much like other labels of that same era, like Atlantic Records. But here's the thing, is that in the beginning, it wasn't even called Motown Records. It was actually called Anna Records. But really, it started with one guy who just had a dream of being able to write, you know, and record music that was created by black musicians and songwriters, but was able to basically cross over into the white audiences and wasn't just specifically for black audiences. And because at the time when Motown was created, you know, the black music of that time was, it was very difficult for, you know, the white audiences to really get into the black music of that specific time frame of the late 50s, because Motown was created at a time when many white artists had to cover a black song in order for it to cross over onto white top 40 radio. So Berry Gordy really had a vision of being able to, you know, break color barriers, and he wanted to write and produce music that was, you know, created entirely by blacks, but it had more of a white sound, and it had the ability to cross over into those white audiences. And that's what he really accomplished. But that's how it started out as. But later on, it would turn into this huge hit-making machine, and it turned into this big, humongous empire of writers and producers and musicians. But that was the original idea for Motown. But let's backtrack a little bit and talk about, you know, where the founder of Motown was before, you know, the label even started. And for those of you, like, diehard Motown fans that listen to this podcast, I apologize if I'm boring you with some very common knowledge slash information. But again, I'm going to try to give you guys some insights to this label and give you some information you might not be aware of. As you know, the label started by Berry Gordy. And as you know, Berry Gordy was originally a songwriter for Jackie Wilson. And Berry Gordy was originally not set on being in the music business. He worked closely with Jackie Wilson, but this was before Jackie Wilson got started as a career as a singer. Before that, he was a boxer, and Berry Gordy was his trainer. And they worked together closely because Berry Gordy was Jackie Wilson's trainer in boxing. And at the time, Jackie Wilson was like, you know what, man, I really don't want to do this anymore. I could get hurt really bad, and then my career is basically over as far as boxing is concerned. I want to try to do something else. I have a really good singing voice. I want to see if I can try to do that as a career. And at the time, Berry Gordy was, you know, really wanted to, you know, he was starting to get interested in being in the music business. But at the same time, when he wrote songs for Jackie Wilson, and by the way, some of the songs include Lonely Teardrops and To Be Loved and a bunch of other songs like, you know, I'll Be Satisfied. And, you know, he wrote a bunch of big hits for Jackie Wilson in the late 50s. And most of the songs he wrote with, you know, Gwen Fuqua and Raquel Billy Davis. And those are his two songwriters that he wrote with quite a bit. And those two songwriters would come in handy as far as the formation of the label in the late in the early 60s. We'll talk about that in just a minute. But first, part of the reason as to why Berry Gordy wanted to start his own record label is that he found out that when he was writing songs for Jackie Wilson, he was really realizing that the money in songwriting wasn't very good. I mean, he was making a lot of money as a songwriter for Jackie Wilson from ASCAP BMI royalty checks that he was getting from performance royalties, but he was realizing that the money in the record business at the time wasn't from just from performance royalties, but the real money was from owning the master recordings of your songs. And that's what he originally set out on wanting to do. He wanted to own his own masters. He didn't want to just be a songwriter and own his own and be basically a publisher for, or he didn't want to just be a songwriter and have someone else own his publishing and just collect money as a writer and that's it. He didn't just want to do that. He wanted to own his own masters. So he was like, you know what? I'm going to start my own record label. And that's what he did. But here's how he did it. He basically borrowed, I think it was $800, which was a lot of money back then. He borrowed $800 from his family as a loan. And at the time, he was like, okay, so I'm going to start this record label, and I'm going to borrow $800 from my family. And if it doesn't work out, it doesn't succeed, I'll just figure out how to pay him back some other way. But he basically borrowed $800 from his family, and he bought this old garage which at the time was located on West Grand Boulevard. And he bought this garage, and he thought, okay, this is where we're going to record all these songs. he invested in a tape recorder machine, and basically he bought the garage, invested in a tape recorder machine, and he realized that he had a lot of what he needed. I mean, you know, he took out doing a DBA and basically said, okay, so I'm going to call this record company to start out called Anna Records. And at the time, you know, he named the company Anna Records after his sister, Anna Gordy. And he thought, okay, so I got the studio, I got the tape machine, and I've got the DBA for the record label, but I need artists to be on my label. And that's when he discovered Marv Johnson. And Marv Johnson became the first artist that was signed to Motown, and that was the first guy that he ever signed, and that was the first guy he ever had real success with. But at the time, you know, he had a tiny little record label in Detroit called Anna Records, and he didn't really have enough money to be able to press enough 45s of copies of singles in order for him to have a decent amount of hits. So the early releases on Anna Records were through other bigger record companies that had stronger distribution arms, like United Artists Records. And a lot of the early Anna Records, 45s were pressed on United Artists Records, which had a stronger distribution arm than he ever did. And at the time, he was like, okay, so I have the studio, I have the tape machine, I have an artist, but I need an A&R man, someone who could basically define the artists I want to sign to a label. And I need an A&R man, someone who could basically find the musicians I could use to, you know, basically be the players on the songs I'm going to put out on my label. And that's when he discovered Mickey Stevenson. And Mickey Stevenson became the A&R man for Motown. And Mickey Stevenson also knew a bunch of really talented jazz musicians who were working in jazz clubs in Detroit at the time, and they were working in clubs like the 20 Grand, and these were musicians that Berry Gordy wind up using on a lot of those early Motown records that he produced and wrote himself mainly. And Mickey Stevenson would bring in these musicians, you know, to record in this tiny little garage studio on West Grand Boulevard. And, you know, at the time, the only artist that he had signed to a label was Marv Johnson. And I believe his first ever single that he ever put out, you know, for Motown, before he was even called Motown, which was Anna Records, that song was called Come to Me. And the follow-up hit to Come to Me, which was You Got What It Takes, wasn't even on Anna Records. It was on United Artists Records. But again, it was all with Berry Gordy producing and the musicians, you know, from the 20 Grand. And essentially what happened was that he had success with Marv Johnson, which was cool, but he needed his own really signature artist that he would essentially promote, you know, and, you know, as a Motown artist, even before it was called Motown. And that's how he discovered Barrett Strong. And Barrett Strong became the first artist to have a top 40 hit with a song that was independently released on the Anna record label. And that song was called Money, That's What I Want. And that song was written by Berry Gordy and Jamie Bradford. And Barrett Strong allegedly co-wrote that song with Berry Gordy, but he supposedly was never given credit for it, and his name never appeared on the original copyright registration of the song, and he sued Berry Gordy, you know, because he was allegedly a co-writer in the song. That's a whole other story. But basically, what happened was that when he got Barrett Strong onto label, and he released Money, That's What I Want, which came out in 1960, actually. And again, these were with the musicians that Mickey Stevens discovered from the Detroit jazz clubs, such as the 20 Grand, and he brought those musicians in to play on, those records that he was producing at the time. And the first little taste of success he had on the pop charts, really, under his own independent label without any major distribution at all, was Money, That's What I Want by Barrett Strong. And that managed to make the top 40 in 1960, and that was really the first real taste of success that, you know, he would ever have as a writer and producer for the Motown label. And Marv Johnson and Bert Strong were the first ever artists that he signed to Motown, but he realized he couldn't do it all himself. So he realized he needed another songwriter and someone else to write for other artists that would later on be signed to the label. And that's where he found Smokey Robinson. Okay, so when Berry Gordy had enough a little bit of success already with Money That's What I Want by Barrett Strong, and he was like, look it, I don't want to write all the songs for this label. I don't want to be the only songwriter working for this label. I need a team. I need other people who can write for me. And here comes Smokey Robinson, who was the guy that was the first songwriter he ever really signed to the label. Before that, he was writing and producing all the songs, and he needed someone else to come in and do some writing and producing, and that's when he discovered Smokey Robinson. Smokey came in, and he basically, auditioned for Berry Gordy with the song that he wrote, which is a response to Silhouettes Get a Job. The song was called Got a Job. And basically, Smokey, played him some songs for him in person, and Berry Gordy was blown away and amazed by how good Smokey was as a writer, both as a lyricist and as a music writer. And he was like, you know what, man, you're really, really good. I'm going to sign you. I want you to be the songwriter for this label. I want you to produce for a label, and I also want you to help me out as far as expanding the label, and I want you to co-head the label as well. And that's basically what he did. He signed Smokey to the label, and with Smokey Robinson, you know, he catapulted Motown into the stratosphere, because what he did is that he was able to at the beginning it was just Anna Records, right? And then what happened was that he created his own subsidiary labels, Gordy Records and Soul Records and the VIP. Well, you know, basically under the Gordy label, he was able to have Smokey write and produce a song that went through a couple of different evolutions before it was a hit. But, you know, once they got the hit version down, there's a whole story behind how that even came about in the first place. I mean, basically, Shop Around was originally just a bluesy song, and then, you know, Berry Gordy called up, you know, him and Smokey Robinson, the musicians, you know, to come in the studio at 4 o'clock in the morning and re-record the song, and they released it and became a huge hit. But that's besides the point. When he hired Smokey Robinson, he was able to catapult the label into the number one spot on the R&B charts, the Shop Around, for the very first time. And this was, again, in the end of 1960, the beginning of 1961. And, you know, at that point, you know, Motown was on a roll. I mean, you know, the next year they had, you know, Smokey formed his own, basically, and with Shop Around, he was able to form his own group, The Miracles, with some of his childhood friends, Bobby Rogers and Marv Tarplin and Warren Moore and his wife, Claudette Robinson. And they basically became the first huge hit band to be signed to Motown Records, and they became arguably the most commercially successful artists on Motown at that time. But then, you know, the label expanded when, you know, Berry Gordy hired Freddie Gorman as a songwriter and producer, and when he hired Brian Hyland and Robert Bateman as songwriters and producers for the label. And when Brian Hyland and Robert Bateman joined the label, Brian Hyland brought his brother along, Eddie, as an artist, along with a good friend of theirs, Lamont Dozier. And they became a very successful writing team for Motown in the mid-60s. But really, you know, when Berry Gordy brought in Brian Hyland and Robert Bateman onto the label, and they wrote and produced Please Mr. Postman, which became Motown's first number one hit on the pop charts, I mean, they were just on a roll. And they became very successful, and Motown also became huge in the UK. And they became very, you know, because Motown had very strong relationships with the distribution labels in the UK. And, you know, and because of this, a lot of the early Motown hits were covered by British artists such as Dusty Springfield, The Beatles, and the Dave Clark Five. And, you know, A lot of Motown songs were covered by British artists, mainly because, you know, the British labels had strong relationships with Motown, as a, you know, and they were able to get a lot of their songs distributed in the UK because of that. But let's talk about, you know, what was it about Motown that made it such a huge success, and what kind of things that they followed that basically made them, you know, into this huge hit-making machine / empire that they became, you know, and basically how they became so huge, and what was it about them that brought them so much success, and what were some of the many different layers of the label that made them work, essentially. Okay, so the one thing you have to keep in mind about Motown, and this is very, very important, is that everything they had about them was in-house. They did not have any other writers from any other publishing companies other than their own writing songs for their artists, and they didn't. And the musicians that were playing on Motown records were not playing on any other, anybody else's records besides them, for the most part. And, you know, they were all under contract with Motown. The artists were under contract with Motown. The songwriters and producers were under contract with Motown. So Berry Gordy kept everything in-house, and that worked for him because he really had exclusivity over his songwriters and his musicians. And, you know, and basically at the time, they all were under contract with the label, so they couldn't really work for anything else, which was different from other establishments in the early 60s, such as the Brill Building and, you know, the British Invasion and some other things, you know, in different places. Because the Brill Building, everything was so separate. I mean, the songwriters work with the publishers, the producers work for record labels, and the musicians work for the musicians union. And, you know, everything was so separate in that regards. But with Motown, it was all in-house. Everything was attached to the label. The musicians were under contract with label. The songwriters were under contract with label. Everything was within Motown Records. And that's what kind of made them work. I mean, there were other labels that were kind of doing this too, like Cameo Parkway, you know, but Motown definitely had the most success, you know, beyond the British Invasion, because when the British Invasion happened, Motown, you know, didn't slow down at all as far as their output of hit songs that they were releasing at that time. I mean, they just continued to have humongous success even after the British Invasion happened, because I feel like their sound and the way their records were produced and arranged and the way their songs were recorded were completely different than what the British musicians were offering at the time. And the British musicians certainly really couldn't, you know, replicate successfully, you know, the same, you know, sound as far as the recordings and the arrangements and the productions that Motown were putting out at this time. Because a lot of the secret ingredient to Motown's success was also the way the songs were recorded, you know, the acoustics and the way, you know, the engineering aspects of the engineers that work for label and the acoustics of the studio that Motown was using at this time. Because at the time, most of the Motown hits were being recorded out of one studio. They literally only used one recording studio, and that was Hitsville Studio A. And Motown earned the nickname Hitsville USA because it basically was, you know, a huge destination for many, many hits that were coming out of the label. And the label's putting out so much music that really, I mean, they just, it was unbelievable the amount of hits that were coming out of that studio and that label. So that's how they earned the nickname Hitsville USA. And yeah, so a lot of the secret ingredients of Motown was the way the records are engineered and the sound of the studio, which was basically a basement garage. I mean, it wasn't anything special or, you know, interesting. It wasn't a large studio, and when you walk, if you watch videos of the studio back, you know, like tours of the studio, you'll notice it's really not that fancy. It wasn't like any other big recording studios of that time frame. It was a small room, and it was just basically a basement, but a lot of hits came out of there, and there was something special about the sound of that basement, which came out on a lot of these hit records. But another very secret ingredient to a lot of Motown records, and the main reason why they had so much success, was just how simple the records sounded. Now, the records, you know, for Motown might have not been simple arrangement-wise, because trust me, if you listen to a lot of those records, there's a lot going on as far as the arrangements is concerned. There's many different moving parts going on at the same time with the guitar parts and the bass and the drums and, you know, the backup vocals and the percussion. There's so much going on as far as the arrangements on those records. But what was the keep it simple, stupid formula that Motown was implementing at that time, what they were referring to was just how simple the chord progressions and the melodies and the lyrics were. You know, because if you listen to the 90% of the early Motown songs from, I want to say like 61, like 64, and even a little bit after that, every single song had a very simple chord progression, not more than one or two, three or four chords used in a single song. And everything was very, very simple as far as the chord changes, and the lyrics are very simple, not really that complicated, and just very straightforward. And that's what made them so successful in the beginning, was just the fact that their music was very simple, not complicated, easy to play for a lot of musicians, and and the lyrics are very simple, not very difficult to understand, and very relatable to both black and white people. And that's what made their music have such a crossover power, because it didn't matter if you're black or white, you could relate to these songs because they talked about things that were relatable to both black and white people. And, you know, essentially that's the formula they followed by. They wanted simple songs, simple chord changes, simple lyrics, and that's what made them such a successful label, was because they really followed the KISS formula, which was the keep it simple, stupid formula, and that's what worked for them. But there are a couple other things about Motown that also made them work as a label, and this is something you may or may not know about. But Motown was very, very selective with the songs that they would release. Unlike other labels at the time that were basically just putting out, whatever songs they wanted to release, really. And, you know, even if it wasn't a hit or not, they were very more experimental with the kind of stuff they were putting out. They were kind of just putting out and see if it stuck or not. Motown, on the other hand, was very, very selective with the amount of singles they were putting out. Even though they were in the Motown artists, most of them recorded a lot of songs, and a lot of it didn't get released. The output of music that was being recorded on that label was just tremendous. There were just so many songs being recorded at the time, but a lot of it didn't get released. And the main reason for this being is because Motown had a team of people working for label that had nothing to do with the production of the songs and the actual arrangements or the recordings or the, you know, these people weren't musicians, but they knew hit songs when they heard them. They really did a good job of being able to predict which songs were going to be hits and which ones weren't. And this team of people that Berry Gordy had working for him, they were known as the quality control department. And basically what happened was that this group of people that worked for the Motown label that weren't musicians but were basically there, you know, to basically listen to these songs and, you know, see which ones would be hits and which ones weren't going to be hits, they would meet every Friday morning and they would listen to the songs that haven't been released yet but were being recorded for a label week to week and day to day. And they would listen to these songs and think to themselves, you know what, let's rate these songs from a scale of 1 to 10. 1, this is not going to be a hit, it's terrible, it sucks, it's not going to get released. And 10, yes, this is going to be a huge hit, it's absolutely amazing, it should get put out. And they would do that. They would basically listen to songs every week, and they would try to figure out which ones are going to be hits and which ones weren't. And 9 times out of 10, they were right when they listened to a song and they said, you know what, this is probably going to be a hit. And that's what they did every week. They reviewed songs every week and decided which ones were going to get released and which ones weren't. And this methodology really worked for Berry Gordy, because with this sort of filter that these records were going through at this time, the label wasn't putting on everything that they were recording. And with this filter that, you know, these records are going through, you know, as to whether or not they would get released or not, and with this being in place for the label, the label managed to have millions and millions of hits, because, you know, these people that were reviewing these records and seeing whether or not they had the potential of becoming a hit and analyzing the song as far as the structure and the chord progression, lyric and melody, you know, the fact that they were able to do this and accurately predict which songs were going to be hits and which ones weren't going to be hits, you know, therefore they were able to have a huge amount of success because these people were right 9 times out of 10. And that's how smart Berry Gordy was, to have a team of people like this working for him, you know, for this label that he basically created from the ground up. And another very important thing that Motown had, a very important ingredient that they had, and, you know, unfortunately, these people that work for the label, they kind of got neglected, really, and they weren't paid very well, but they were so important to the label, and I'd feel really bad if I didn't mention them, because these people were really, really important for a label, were the musicians that played on the songs. Now, these musicians that work for Motown, they only pretty much played on their records and that's it, but they were so talented and they were so good at being able to create their own parts on their records and be very creative in the studio and add so much to the records, you know, and just be so creative and not just play what was written to them on the lead sheets when they were recording these songs. And these musicians were known as the Funk Brothers. And these musicians included not just James Jamerson on bass, but he was very much a part of the Motown sound, but Eddie Willis, Joey Messina, Robert White on guitar, Earl Van Dyke, Johnny Griffin, Joe Hunter on piano and organ, and Richard Pistol Allen, Benny Benjamin, and Muriel Jones on drums. And also they had Jack Ashford and Jack Perkenshaw on percussion. And there was some other musicians, too. And, you know, and that was basically the rhythm section on these songs. I mean, there were a couple of people added on later, like Eddie Wild, Watson, Dennis Coffey on guitar, and Bob Abbott on bass. But that was really the core rhythm section on a lot of these records. Eddie Bongo Brown playing the bongos. And, you know, that was basically the guys who played on all these records. And there was a lot of other horn players, too, and they were very much a part of this, the sound, the Motown sound, too, like Azuka Mafia and, you know, Eugene Will Bill Moore and Andrew Mike Terry and just a ton of other really cool musicians, horn players that played on these records. But the core of these songs were really the rhythm section that played on all these hits. But the thing is about this rhythm section was that, unlike last week, you know, when I talked about Stax Records, the musicians who played on the Motown records were not very well known at the time. You know, unlike Stax, these musicians rarely went on tour. I mean, they actually, take that back. You know, these musicians did go on tour with, you know, the Marvelettes and Marvin Gaye and, you know, the Martha Rays and the Vandellas. They did go on the road with these musicians in the beginning when they did those, when Berry Gordy choreographed those Motown review shows. But, you know, they also went to Europe. But at the time, very few people knew about the Funk Brothers. And they never really got credit on the albums or the singles. Very few people really knew about them, really. And, you know, at the time, the musicians, you know, it was a job for them to, you know, go in the studio and play these songs and basically get paid. But they never really got the fame that the artists were getting at that time, like the Supremes and the Four Tops and the Temptations. They really were kind of being neglected, and Berry Gordy a lot of times didn't even pay them fairly, you know, and that, you know, didn't really sit well with a lot of the musicians that were working for label at that time. They finally got credit when they played on Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, but that wasn't until 1971. So, and these guys were working for the label right from the very beginning when Motown first started in 1959. But again, with Motown following the Keep It Simple Stupid formula and just how much success they were having, you know, as a label, following that formula with the songs they're writing and producing, I mean, let me put it to you this way. They had success that could rival both the Beatles and the Beach Boys and the Four Seasons in 1964 and 65. I mean, they were very powerful American establishment, you know, for, you know, popular music at that time. They were very successful. You know, I mean, Motown was having all these hits, but nobody really knew too much about the musicians on these songs, and they kind of stood back and never really were in the spotlight as far as fame is concerned. And there were other musicians who were like that too, working for other labels, but, you know, again, it's like these guys were not famous. And It wasn't until years and years later until they actually became well known. And basically, you know, they made a whole documentary about them called Seeing the Shadows of Motown. But again, very few people really know a whole lot about these guys unless you're a diehard Motown fan, you know. But again, it's like there's these songs that came out of these labels so recognizable and just so huge that, you know, anybody really, really can recognize the songs that they played on. And, you know, I mean, everything from I Heard It Through the Grapevine to My Girl to, you know, Can't Hurry Love. I mean, they played on so many hits, but very few people know about them. But they were so important to the Motown sound because without the Funk Brothers, there wouldn't have been a Motown. Period. End of story. These guys, you know, without the Funk Brothers, Motown would have never existed. And they were such an important ingredient to the Motown sound, along with the way the records were produced and engineered and the sound of the studio, Hitsville Studio A, the Keep It Simple Super formula, the songs were following. Yeah, all that was the main reason why Motown was such a huge successful label in the 60s. But moving on, before I wrap up this podcast, I wanted to actually talk about the history behind the song and the artist that recorded it and, you know, and the writer that wrote the song and produced it. Because I know the last couple episodes of this podcast when I talked about Stax and the one I'm doing right now with Motown, they were kind of lengthy. And it's mainly because these two labels, Stax and Motown, had such in-depth history behind all of them. I mean, there's just so many things that happen with the history behind, you know, all their success and the things and all the changes that they went through over the years. And I try to keep this podcast in more of a condensed sort of bite-sized format so that way you guys aren't totally just, you know, I lost as far as what I'm talking about and as far as the things I'm explaining to you in this podcast. You guys aren't, you know, trying to do something else. So I'm going to try to keep it concise and jump right into the history behind the song and the artist that recorded it. Okay, so as all you know by now, if you guys listen to the song was recorded by the Originals. Now, if you know about Motown, you know about the Temptations, you know about the Supremes, you know about the Four Tops, you know about Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, but you might not know about the Originals because, like I said before, you know, the Funk Brothers, the guys, the musicians that played on a lot of these records, they originally were never given credit for playing on these songs on the original 45 picture sleeves of these singles that they were playing on. And the same goes with this group because the Originals were originally not a group signed to Motown. They were just a group of session singers that were contracted to Motown specifically to sing on other artists' songs. So they were on songs by Marvin Gaye, they were on songs by the Four Tops, and they were on songs by Martha Reeves and the Vandellas. They were the male group that basically sang backup for all these artists. And they sang backup on all these artists, and for a long time that was what they were essentially paid to do by Berry Gordy. They were essentially paid to sing backup on all these songs because at the time Motown had a female backup group called the Undantes, and the Undantes were essentially Motown's female backup group, so they backed up a lot of different groups at that time. And so essentially the Originals were the male backup vocal group for Motown, and the Undantes were the female backup group for Motown, and together they sang on a lot of hit records. But for a long time the Originals were just a session backup group and they did not have any hit songs of their own. And it wasn't until around 1969 in which they were signed to Motown as artists finally, and this is what happened, this is how they got their first hit record. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about Marvin Gaye, because Marvin Gaye actually was the guy who wrote and produced the song. And let's talk a little bit about what got him to really write and produce the song in the first place. Because Marvin Gaye at the time was kicking around for Motown for a while, and he definitely was the most commercially successful male artist on Motown next to Stevie Wonder. But for a long time, he always had struggles with, you know, the Berry Gordy, the head of Motown, and just everyone that worked for that label and what he really wanted to do as far as being an artist and songwriter is concerned. Because in the very beginning, when he first got signed to Motown in 1961, It was brought into label by Harvey Fuqua. Harvey Fuqua and Marvin Gaye were in a group together called the Moonglows, and Harvey Fuqua knew Berry Gordy, and therefore Marvin Gaye was brought into label as first a session musician playing on records by the Marvelettes, and then that's when he got signed as an artist in 1961. But anyways, the power struggle between Marvin Gaye and Motown as far as what he wanted to do, as far as what the label wanted to do, started from the very beginning. And because in 1961, when he first got signed to Motown as an artist, Marvin Gaye did not want to do pop soul songs. In a sense, he didn't want to be like a Sam Cooke. He didn't want to do songs of that nature. He actually wanted to be more of an adult contemporary lounge jazz singer a la Nat King Cole. And Motown allowed him to do this, actually, briefly, because he recorded a whole album of jazz standards. And what happened was that that album of jazz standards tanked. It did not do very well at all. And so when this happened, Berry Gordy's like, look it, man, you know, I let you record an album of jazz standards. It didn't do very well. So if you really want to have success in this business, you got to do some pop songs. And even though Marvin Gaye was totally resistant with doing this, he was like, okay, I'll do it. I mean, he didn't really want to do it to begin with. He, like I said before, he just wanted to do jazz standards and be like a Nat King Cole, but he wasn't having too much luck with that, so he decided to do these pop songs. And that's when the ball started to roll for him as far as his success, you know, in the music business was concerned. He started to have many, many hits. And most of these songs that he was recording at this time, you know, were written by Mickey Stevenson, and sometimes he wrote some of these songs. But the point of me saying this is that 90% of the songs that Marvin Gaye recorded for Motown in the 60s were songs that he did not produce. These are songs that he had other people produce, and for the most part, other people write for him as well. I mean, Smokey Robinson wrote a ton of hits for Marvin Gaye in the mid-60s, Ain't That Peculiar, One More Heartache, Pretty Little Baby, a bunch of songs. And and also Holland Dozier Holland wrote Can I Get a Witness, a huge hit for him in 1963. He had a lot of different songwriters and producers writing and producing for him. But in the beginning, he really wanted to do that himself. And for a long time, the label just wouldn't let him do that at all. And this continued for quite a while, clear out to when they decided, you know what, Marvin Gaye is a good-looking young black guy. Let's pair him up with a female artist on our label. They first tried Mary Wells, and that did okay. I mean, they had a couple hits with her, but then she left Motown to go over to 20th Century Fox, and unfortunately that didn't pan out too well for her. And also, after that, they paired him up with Kim Weston, and that resulted in some hits, but Kim Weston ultimately only really had one hit with Marvin Gaye, and that's it. I mean, she had a huge regional hit with Take Me in Your Arms, Rock Me for a Little While, but that was about it, really. But then, after that, they teamed him up with an artist that they discovered themselves, who was originally on a couple, not on Motown originally. She was on Scepter and a bunch of different New York labels. And with this girl named Tammy Montgomery, they also brought in a couple pair of New York real building songwriters who got signed to Motown as songwriters, their first pair of outside writers writing for Motown, and those writers were Nick Ashford and Valerie Simpson, and they got signed to the Joe Bett Music Publishing arm of Motown, and I think they actually discovered them because Motown opened up offices in New York for the first time, and that's when they first got a hold of Ashford and Simpson. But before that, they were writing songs for Ray Charles and doing stuff for other labels, but they got signed to Motown, and they started producing a bunch of hits for Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell, starting with Ain't No Mountain High Enough, and then Ain't Nothing Like the Real Thing, and You All Need to Get By, a bunch of really big hits. And then what happened was that, you know, Tammy Terrell had a brain aneurysm. She actually had a brain tumor. She became critically ill and very, very, not well at all. And this really, really did a number on Marvin Gaye, because he really had a hard time with this because he was having a ton of success. So, I mean, Norman Whitfield and Barrett Strong are writing a lot of big hits for Marvin Gaye. I mean, I heard The Grapevine, That's the Way the World, that's Earth, Wind, Fire. That's the Way Love Is. That was a song that Norman Whitfield and Barrett Strong wrote for Marvin Gaye. And then they also wrote Too Busy Thinking About My Baby. A bunch of huge hits. But all this time, Marvin Gaye was just a puppet to those guys. I mean, he was basically, you know, singing songs and, you know, that weren't his to begin with, and they weren't, and he was doing them exactly the way these songwriters, producers wanted him to do these songs. I mean, he was a puppet, you know, to Norman Whitfield and Barrett Strong and Smokey Robinson. And at one point, Marvin Gaye just had it with that. He really, really wanted to write and produce for Motown, but Berry Gordy just wouldn't let him do it for the longest time. And it wasn't until he wrote this song, which, by the way, the song went through a couple different rewrites. It wasn't called Baby On For Real originally. It was called, it was under a different title. And he wrote the song for Bobby Taylor and Vancouver's, which were an artist that was on a Motown subsidiary label. I think it was the Gordy label. I'm pretty sure it was. They were on a Motown subsidiary label. They had one hit under that label, and then they kind of tanked. They were actually a Canadian group, which had, Tommy Chong in it from Cheech and Chong. It's a whole other story. But anyways, Marvin Gaye wrote a song for them, and he decided he wanted to rewrite it and change it, and he wanted to pitch it for the Originals, which hadn't had, and that group, which consisted of Freddie Gorman, who also wrote a bunch of songs for Motown, including hit songs for the Marvelettes, and he did some other stuff too for other labels, but he was kicking around for Motown for a while too, and he was a member of this group. And essentially, Marvin Gaye decided to rewrite the song that he originally intended for Bobby Taylor and Vancouver's, and he decided to write it for the Originals. And he pitched it to Berry Gordy. He says, look, man, this is a big hit. This is going to be a really, really good hit song for the Originals. They haven't had a hit yet under their own name. Please let me produce this. And, you know, please let me place a song with them. I really, really want to go on my own as a writer and a producer. And Berry Gordy is like, okay, man, you've been with us for a while. You've had a ton of success, you know, with other people writing and producing for you. This sounds like a strong enough song for the Originals to record. I'll let you record and produce this one. And that's exactly what happened. Marvin Gaye produced the song for the Originals, and he wrote it with his then wife, Anna Gordy Gaye. And I believe they're going through a divorce at this time too. Anna Gordy Gaye was Berry Gordy's sister, and Marvin and Anna were married at the time, but they were also going through a divorce. And with all that was going on, they wrote this song for the Originals, and it was called Baby On For Real. Marvin Gaye produced this song for the Originals. And what happened was that this song actually charted. It got into the top 20 in late 1969. And he managed to score another hit with the Originals, you know, and here's another thing. So we've talked about this before on my podcast. You know, it was so common back then for one artist to have a huge hit and then the next song to sound almost exactly like the follow-up hit. I mean, sorry, the follow-up hit sounded almost exactly like the first hit, like almost no difference. This was a good example of that because their Originals' next hit, The Bells, was, in fact, sounded so much like Baby One For Real. It was almost the same song. It totally was pretty much almost identical to Baby On For Real. And so Marvin Gaye wrote and produced two hits for the Originals. And by the way, one notable thing I wanted to mention to you about Baby On For Real was that it was a different kind of a song than what Motown was putting out at this time. Because at this time, Motown was very, very focused on doing these really heavy, hard, psychedelic, you know, soul records by the Temptations and, you know, Psychedelic Shack and all these, you know, Can't Get Next to You and Don't Let the Joneses Get You Down and Cloud Nine. I mean, Norman Whitfield was really, really just trying to, you know, really take the Temptations on more of a harder psychedelic level. And essentially what happened was that this particular song, on the other hand, was nothing like that at all. In fact, it was basically a return to the more back-to-basics doo-wop kind of a style. In fact, it sounded a lot like a Philadelphia soul record, songs that were being put out by groups like the Delphonics and the Intruders. But again, this had nothing to do with those two groups at all, because this was being recorded in Detroit, not in Philadelphia, and on a Motown label, not a Philadelphia International label, and not produced by Gannon Campbell, Leon Huff, or Tom Bell. But it did sound like a lot like that, because the lush strings and the very laid-back, very just not super groove-heavy arrangement at all. I mean, it did sound a lot like one of those Philadelphia Soul songs, but again, it had nothing to do with that. It was produced by Marvin Gaye and written by him with his wife, Anna Gordy Gaye. And one other notable thing I wanted to say about Baby I'm For Real, and I forgot to mention this in the first part of this podcast, is that I don't know if you noticed this, but every singer on the song, there's not one lead vocalist on this whole record. They actually, the members of this group actually took turns singing lead on the song. And that's exactly what was going on with the Temptations. Because before, Temptations only really had David Ruffin, and he was the lead singer. And then they alternated between David Ruffin and Eddie Kendricks. Then when David left in the group, and then Dennis Edwards joined the group, they started trading off lead vocals. And then literally there was no one lead singer in the Temptations. Well, the exact same thing happened with the Originals. There was not just one lead vocalist in this group. You know, every singer in this group traded off lead vocals for the song. And that ultimately led to the 90s boy band groups of, you know, that time. And because they never really had really one lead singer ever, either. They had people, they had the guys in the group trading off lead vocals for each lyric in the song. They didn't just have one guy singing lead the entire time. And, you know, and that was true for a lot of groups like Boyz II Men and even groups like NSYNC and the Backstreet Boys. And one more thing I wanted to mention before I close out this podcast. What was so significant about the success of this song, Baby I'm For Real, having been written by Marvin Gaye and produced by Marvin Gaye, is that the success of Baby I'm For Real by the Originals, having been written and produced by Marvin Gaye, that ultimately led him to producing and basically writing every single song for his landmark album, in which came out a couple of years after Baby I'm For Real in 1971, called What's Going On. Because if it hadn't been for the song and for the success of the song, you know, we might not have heard the classic songs from the album, from What's Going On. We never might have heard Mercy, Mercy Me, The Ecology, or Inner City Blues, or any of those songs, because again, it was the success of Baby I'm For Real, having it being a top 20 hit in the fall of 1969. If it wasn't for the success of that song, Berry Gordy might not have been convinced that Marvin Gaye was a good enough writer and producer, you know, on his own without Norman Whitfield and Barrett Strong or Smokey Robinson or any of those guys. So, this was the song that ultimately led him to writing and producing What's Going On, you know, because Baby I'm For Real came out a couple of years before What's Going On, and also it was written and produced by Marvin Gaye, so there is that. Another notable thing that happened with Motown is that they were the second record company to acquire an 8-track tape machine after Atlantic Records. And basically what happened with this was that the Atlantic Records was the first record company to acquire an 8-track tape machine. Motown was the second. So because of this, they were able to basically record the entire track, you know, by and isolate all the instruments on that track and be able to multi-track the whole record and do the guitars first and then bass and then drums and then all the other instruments followed. And then they would overdub strings and backup vocals and lead vocals and horns, and they would all be on separate tracks. And because of this, a lot of Motown songs were actually began as simply backing tracks. And then what the producers would do is that they would come in and write lyric and melody on top of that backing track and then basically have one of their groups recorded. And that was the case with Baby I Need Your Lovin' by the Four Tops and Ain't Too Proud to Beg by the Temptations. All those songs, they all just started when the producers of those records, which were Norman Whitfield and Hollander Holland, they all produced the backing track entirely, you know, without a lyric and melody. And basically, what they did after they produced the backing track is that they wrote a lyric and melody to the song, and they had the Temptations and the Four Tops record it. And also, just a quick little epilogue on what happened with Motown is that, you know, they continued very, very much later into the 70s with the Jackson 5 and Diana Ross and a bunch of other, you know, groups. But definitely what happened with Motown was that Berry Gordy wanted to get out of Detroit really, really bad. He was in Detroit for basically 90% of Motown's hit-making career in the 60s. But by the beginning of the 70s, he really, really wanted to explore and get out of Detroit and move to Los Angeles, because I feel like by that time, L.A. was starting to really become the hub for the music industry by the early 70s. So he really wanted to get out of Detroit, and he did, actually, and set up offices in L.A. and actually move their entire headquarters to Los Angeles. And another reason why he did this is because he really wanted Motown to break into the filmmaking industry and the film and TV industry. And they did this, but I think that what happened was that since Berry Gordy didn't really stick to just music only, I felt like that might have been what the demise of Motown, because after that whole chain of events happened that kind of led to the decline of Motown. But really, all Berry Gordy wanted to do was expand the company and didn't want it to do more things other than just put out records. And that's kind of what happened once the 60s turned into the 70s. And once Motown moved to L.A., their core group of studio musicians were left behind, and he formed a new one in L.A. And that's a whole nother story from a whole nother podcast. But that concludes part two, episode number 103 of my 60 Music Podcast, The Millennial Throwback Machine. I'm Sam Williams, and again, this is a long podcast episode. I noticed it's an hour-long episode. And again, I want to say I'm sorry if this went on a little too long, but Motown has a lot of in-depth history behind their label, and I want to cover a lot of ground about them with this one episode of this podcast. So again, you know, I try to keep these solo episodes around 30 to 40 minutes, but sometimes they can run a little bit longer, and this is just one of those cases where it just ran a little bit longer because there's a lot I want to cover with Motown, but I'm sure you guys will appreciate it anyways. I mean, I'm sure if you found this interesting, you made it this far into this episode. But anyways, if you did find some interesting facts and information about this last week's artist, the originals, and you never really knew anything about them before, please email me at samltwilly@icloud.com, and you can also reach out to me on Instagram, iHeartOldies, and don't check out my website yet, because I'm still in the process of rebuilding it. I'm in the middle of doing that right now, and I'll let you guys know when that is up. But in the meantime, you can check out the official Spotify and YouTube playlist for this podcast. You'll be able to find all the songs I've talked about on my show so far, including this one. Hopefully, that'll give you some ideas for some songs on my podcast that I haven't covered yet that I should cover soon. And if that does give you any of those ideas, please email those to me at samltwilly@icloud.com or reach out to me on Instagram at iHeartOldies. A link to those things in the description of this episode of this podcast, and the link to last week's song is in the description of this episode of this podcast as well. You can find the link to the Spotify and YouTube playlist in the description of this episode of this podcast, and you can find a link to this really cool Redbubble merch tour I have for this podcast with the name of my podcast on the bottom and the catchphrase I say at the end of every episode and keep on trucking tight as the main logo for the podcast. And you know, and that is on these really cool merchandise items that you can purchase on there if you wanted to. You can find the link to that in the description of this episode of this podcast. If you would like to buy something, I'd appreciate it, but if you don't want to, that's okay. I'd love if you can give me some feedback on each item in the store as far as the price and the logo that's attached to each item. You can do that by emailing me at samltwilly@icloud.com, or you can also reach out to me on Instagram at iHeartOldies. So yeah, also, if you guys are randomly discovering this podcast on iTunes, please leave me a review of the Apple Podcast app, because the more reviews I get, the more my show gets pushed into the new noteworthy section in iTunes, and more than likely, that'll help my podcast blow up quite a bit. But anyway, so I'm Sam Williams, and thank you for joining me for this week's episode of my podcast, The Millennial Throwback Machine. Till next week, please! Keep things moving.